Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show about science, technology, and the future of our environment. It's Election Day, and for those of you still planning to cast your ballot, you're probably going to vote on a touchscreen. Maybe you registered to vote online, looked up your polling place, or you're a little bit like me and have been obsessively refreshing the website for early voter turnout. In short, technology has transformed the way we vote. Here to talk about that tech, how it makes it easier to vote and harder to cheat, is Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose. Welcome back to All Sides, Secretary.
Well, thank you, Anna, and happy Election Day.
Happy Election Day. The polls opened a little over 4 hours ago. Can you tell us who's winning yet?
No, I can't. Well, I can tell you Ohioans are winning because it's been a really smooth Election Day so far. 35,000 of our fellow Ohioans, half Republicans, half Democrats, are running close to 3,200 polling locations, and things are going quite smoothly. As you know, we've already had over 2.5 million ballots cast in the 4 weeks of early voting, and I think we could be on track for another record-setting election. At least I hope so, as Ohioans continue to show up in large numbers today.
So the machines that we all vote on, the touchscreens, I want to talk a little bit about how they work and what they do or don't do. First of all, we have backups? Do you have extra machines if some go down or stop functioning?
Yeah, absolutely. Every county board of elections, first of all, chooses what style of voting equipment they use. And so some counties do use a touchscreen machine that prints off your paper ballot. In other counties, you fill in an oval like a Scantron test, and then it goes through a scanner. But in all cases, those machines are tested by bipartisan teams through a full battery of tests called the Logic and Accuracy Test. That was done weeks ago. And then, of course, they have backup machines at the polling location, but also back at the Board of Elections if there were to be a failure and those machines need to be replaced on Election Day.
And these voting machines are never connected to the internet. Can you explain why?
Well, it's important for Ohioans to understand this because so many false rumors out there are all based on this one incorrect idea that voting machines are somehow connected to the internet and can be remotely tampered with. Let me be abundantly clear about something. Voting machines in Ohio can never connect to the internet. We don't buy machines that are even capable of an internet connection. They don't have a Wi-Fi connection, a Bluetooth connection, a LAN connection, no modem, nothing that connects it to the outside world. In fact, the only thing that machine can connect to is the wall outlet that powers it. And it's also important to note that every ballot in Ohio is on paper, 100%, without exception. And so, yeah, the voting machine gives us that rapid count on election night that we want, and we want to know that result on election night. If you had to, say, hand count every ballot in Ohio, we wouldn't know the winner until after Thanksgiving. But we also count the paper. That happens through what's called a post-election audit. So we don't just have paper. We don't just have electronic voting. We have both operating in parallel, and the two have to reconcile.
So then how does my county communicate to you my numbers? Is that emailed to you then?
So it's on election night when the voting location closes. Of course, at 7:30, that's when that happens. Anybody that is in line still gets to vote. The very first ballots that get counted and are reported by 8:15 on election night, those are the early votes and the absentee votes. Intuitively, those are already at the Board of Elections. But then as the boards, as the voting locations are shutting down, a Republican and a Democrat get in a car together because we always have a strict bipartisan chain of custody. So yes, a DNR work together and do so in a good patriotic way. That's the way elections are run in Ohio. And they drive that equipment and they drive those memory sticks and the hard copy ballots down to the Board of Elections. Those probably arrive at the Board of Elections somewhere in the 8:30 to 9 o'clock hour. And that's when they start to tabulate those Election Day votes. Now, you asked how that gets reported to us. We have a secure connection with each county Board of Elections, and that's how they transmit those either every half hour or every hour, depending on the size of the county. But the immutable record, the official record, is still physically there at the Board of Elections. As we receive those electronically from the Board of Elections, we have a team that we call the Election Night Reporting Team, actually here in my office, that is on the phone, checking with the Boards of Elections, reconciling those, quality checking those to make sure that what was sent is the same thing that was received and make sure that fidelity is there. And then, of course, we report that number out to the general public on our website, voteohio.gov.
Which I'll be refreshing regularly this evening.
And it'll automatically refresh every 3 minutes if you don't want to keep hitting refresh.
Well, perhaps that says something about my personality, that I will hit the button even though I know logically it can't have refreshed yet. But you also recently introduced a data analytics dashboard on the Secretary of State's website that, for someone like me, it's been super helpful for tracking who has voted, demographic breakdowns, snapshots of the counties. What made you want to build this public interface?
Well, because there's nothing to hide in elections administration, and the more transparency, the more public data we put out there, the better. What it really gives the public a chance to do is understand why I can say without hesitation that it's easy to vote and it's hard to cheat in Ohio. And that data dashboard came about as a result of a bill I worked to get the legislature to pass, and that creates really an example for the rest of the nation to follow in the level of transparency that we have. In the past, it was spreadsheets and that kind of thing. But this data dashboard, and you can find it at ohiosos.gov/data, allows you to look at how many ballots have been requested, how many ballots have been returned. These are absentee ballots. How did people return them? Did they return them to the drop box, or did they mail them, or did they personally bring them to the elections officials? It allows you to see how many people have participated in early voting. And as you say, it allows you to look at demographic data such as age, party affiliation, and where those ballots came from, if they were coming in from, for example, maybe our military men and women serving overseas, or whether they're coming in from people here in Ohio. Again, great information. And what it tells us is over 31% of our fellow Ohioans, over 31% of registered voters, have already voted during the 4 weeks of early voting. And that's great news.
Yeah, it also allows folks like me to look at county by county results to see if I can read any early tea leaves. Like, I looked at Mahoning and Trumbull counties, which Brown will need to win if he's going to win this election. And more Democrats have voted early in those than Republicans. But Ottawa Wood and Ashtabula have more Republican turnout, and he's going to need those too. So who knows? It's going to be a close race. I guess that's all I can say about that.
And interestingly, and again, this is something we hadn't seen before, Republicans have outvoted Democrats in the early voting numbers. That's not a normal thing. In fact, as a Republican, I would tell you that not too many years ago, Republicans would have felt pretty good being only down a few hundred thousand going into Election Day. But the numbers, again, we don't know how people voted, but we know that the number of registered Republicans and the number of registered Democrats, Republicans have been outvoting Democrats in Ohio this year by over 250,000. The other thing the data dashboard gives us a chance to do is, well, we call it a dashboard for a reason. The dashboard on your car tells you if something's not running smoothly in your vehicle. And the same thing with this, with 88 county boards of elections and human errors and that kind of thing. It gives us an early view into if something's not going smoothly. I'll give you an example. In Mahoning County, we saw early on that the rate of ballot returns is not what we would have expected. Normally, within the first couple of days of early voting, you start seeing absentee ballots coming back. What we were able to quickly ascertain because of this data dashboard is that there was a print vendor that was behind. They'd perhaps overcommitted and underdelivered, and they weren't getting those ballots out in the mail quickly. We were able to then step in and get that situation rectified well in advance of Election Day. So again, we were able to shortcut that problem before it became a much more significant one.
Can I ask what steps are being taken to address the digital divide and ensure that all eligible voters have equal access to the technology and the resources?
Well, as you know, we are a big, diverse state, and Ohio's county boards of elections reflect the diversity of Ohio. We've got county boards of elections that are very small operations where it's two people that work in the courthouse, and then we've got counties like Franklin, Hamilton, Cuyahoga, where it's a large and very sophisticated operation with many, many people involved. But of course, Ohio's voters reflect that same diversity. So we want to make sure that, well, for example, in counties where there's maybe a large percentage of Amish that choose to participate in the process, that they have sort of non-digital ways of accessing this kind of information as well. For Ohioans with disabilities, in fact, I just retweeted something from the Ohio Department that helps Ohioans with disabilities that made it clear that voting is available for all Ohioans, regardless of ability or disability levels. And so we take steps to make sure, for example, for those that are visually disabled, that there are options. For those who have other disabilities, that there are options available as well. Nobody should be left out of the voting process as long as you're over 18 and a U.S. citizen registered to vote.
Let's talk a little bit about the results that are going to come in tonight. So we'll get some early results probably around 8:30-ish. How much stock should we put in the early results?
Well, I'll tell you, it's just that. It's early results. The first results that you're going to get are going to be the absentee votes and the early votes. And then again, later in the evening, you'll see more numbers come in. And so people can draw whatever conclusions they wish from that. I will tell you that it often follows a rather predictable pattern for us. Sometime around 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, we should be at 80 or 90% reporting. In many cases, members of the press will have started to call races and say, hey, this is a conclusive result. But it's possible that some of those races won't be conclusive at that point. And we'll continue counting until we've counted every election day vote on election night. What that means is that whether it takes us to 3-4 in the morning on Wednesday morning, and sometimes it does, but before we go to bed, we'll have all of those election day votes counted. It's important to look at this number, Anna, and this is something I've intentionally added to our election night reporting website. Again, that's voteohio.gov if you want to see it directly from the source. And that is a number that I call the denominator. It's the total outstanding absentee and provisional ballot number. Why that matters is if you're following a statewide candidate and that candidate is ahead by 50,000 votes when we close out election night reporting, and there's 200,000 or 300,000 outstanding ballots that still could count, well, then just numerically speaking, that race is not over yet, and we're going to have to wait for the final certified result. Likewise, if you're following a candidate that's ahead by 300 or 400,000 votes on election night, and there's only 300,000 outstanding ballots that still could potentially count, well, that race is over, and you can call that one conclusive. So it's an important thing to look at if there is a tight race here in Ohio.
And one of the things that reporters look at when we make those calls is where the outstanding ballots are, because you can say if past is predictive, and sometimes it isn't always, but if, say, there's a bunch of outstanding votes in Franklin County, that means one thing. If there's a bunch of outstanding votes in Butler County, that might mean another thing. And sometimes just looking at what county still has stuff left can give you an indication of who those people may have voted for. But that's a little squishier than you guys probably do over at the Secretary of State's office.
We just report what the voters had to say and then, of course, respect the voice of the people of Ohio. And here's the thing. We run elections so well that the loser knows they lost. That's my standard, right? Of course the winner knows they won. They're going to go give a victory speech. We need to do our job so well, so above reproach, so transparently that hopefully sometime around 10 or 11, the losing candidates look at that and say, you know what? I trust that this was an honest result. I need to try harder next time. I'm going to call the winner and congratulate them. That's our standard, to do it so well that the losers know they lost.
I want to get into some recent changes in just a moment, but I do want to ask quickly about recounts. What are the rules for a recount? What is the threshold we have to reach?
Yeah, so for a statewide, it's within a quarter of a percent. Within a district election, it's within a half a percent. And then, of course, candidates can request a recount, at which they have to, you know, bear the cost of doing that if they choose, if they're outside of that margin. Again, those are the kind of things that can happen, and our boards of elections are ready to do that. It's important to point out that those recounts usually don't show much of a difference, because we've got a really accurate way of counting those results. Again, that electronic count we give you on election night, which is also backed up by that paper hand count audit, which we do in every election.
So some of the recent changes that we've made to how we vote, first and foremost, we're all bringing our IDs, but it is important to note that if you forget yours, you can vote provisionally and then you can come back later today or you can come back tomorrow and bring it in and fix it. Have you guys seen any problems with that or the requirement to bring in proof of citizenship if your license still says non-citizens? Is that going smoothly?
It's going very smoothly. And here's the thing. Ohioans expect that they're going to show their ID. For 98% of us, really over decades, that's already been the case. Most Ohioans, long before this was a requirement, would check in with their state ID or their driver's license. There's alternative forms that you can use as well, such as a military ID, which I've used, or a passport. Again, you can get the full list at voteohio.gov. In addition to your ID, also bring a smile. The reason I say that, thank those poll workers. These are 35,000 of our fellow Ohioans, Democrats, Republicans, working together. Be patient with them, be kind to them, and thank them for the work that they're doing. If you don't have your ID, if the dog ate it, then yes, you'll fill out what's called a provisional ballot. This is not something to be afraid of. It's actually a safeguard that's in place to make sure that no one misses out on the chance to make their voice heard, because really, this is a no-fail mission today. We've got from 6:30 a.m. until 7:30 p.m. If you fill out a provisional ballot, it won't count tonight. But what it is a chance to do is register your vote, and then it's set aside so that in the next few days after the election, you can come down to the Board of Elections with your ID, validate that you are who you say you are, and then, of course, that envelope comes out of the stack and will go into the ballot box to be counted in the official certified result, the one that happens in 3 weeks. Now, you mentioned non-citizens. If you have a state driver's license that says non-citizen on it, but you have recently naturalized, well, first of all, we sent reminders to all those folks that they should go ahead and get an updated driver's license that doesn't still have that non-citizen indicator on it. But if you are in that circumstance, and we're talking about a small number of people, you should bring your naturalization certificate, your proof of citizenship, so that you can have a smooth experience on election day. And of course, if you have to fill out a provisional ballot, you're still able to bring that naturalization certificate down to the Board of Elections over the next couple of days.
And if you are dropping off a ballot for somebody who is disabled, there is a rule change now where you have to go in and you have to fill out a form. How is that going?
That's correct. And in fact, I did that myself. So the rule is in Ohio is that you can only possess somebody else's ballot. You can only deliver somebody else's ballot in one of two circumstances. One, it's a family member, or two, it's for a disabled Ohioan who has designated you to assist them. In all other cases, you're just not allowed to handle somebody else's ballot. This is that chain of custody that we work through to make sure that we have that sort of secure bipartisan chain of custody throughout the process. And so when you're returning your own ballot, you can put it in the drop box. If you're bringing anybody else's, you have to bring it to the elections officials. I brought my ballot and Lauren's ballot, my wife's ballot, to the Franklin County Board of Elections, simply went inside, filled out this quick attestation, and then dropped them in. And the reason why that is relevant still at this point, if you still have an absentee ballot, we know there's close to 200,000 that are still out there. If you still have that absentee ballot sitting on your dashboard, sitting on your kitchen table, it's not too late to get it in, but it is too late to mail it. At this point, you would need to take it to your county Board of Elections, not your polling location. They may not accept absentee ballots at polling locations. It's got to be at your Board of Elections before 7:30 tonight.
Final question for you is about wearing political slogans into your polling place. We are allowed to wear slogans, but not political candidate names. What is the clarification here?
Yeah, so this is something that has long been the law in the state of Ohio. It says that you're not allowed to campaign inside a polling location. This has been interpreted differently by different boards of elections. And maybe some extreme situations, we've had boards of elections interpret that very strictly and say if you're wearing a high school mascot on your shirt, then that expresses support for that school levy. Well, that's maybe not the case.
That feels like a stretch.
Maybe just your kid plays ball for that team. But what we've said is, let's just be clear about this. Let's not let this become a distraction. It can't have the name of a candidate. It can't have the candidate's logo. It can't say vote for this levy, vote against this state issue. Otherwise, it's a place on election day that's not for campaigning. It's a place for voting. Our poll workers will instruct you if you insist on wearing some sort of candidate attire. They'll tell you you're violating the law. They'll put your name down because you could end up referred to the Board of Elections or potentially even the county prosecutor because it is a violation. But we're not going to keep any registered voter from casting their ballot. The other thing, Anna, that we're not going to do is be part of somebody's attempt to create a conflict, to make a social media video or whatever else. We've got work to do, and that is making sure that millions of Ohioans cast their ballots today. So again, be kind to your poll workers, follow their instructions, and save the campaigning for outside of the voting location.
That was Ohio Secretary of State Frank LaRose. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Anna.
Coming up, how the two presidential candidates might handle the future of artificial intelligence. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we talk science, technology, and the future of our environment. The outcome of the presidential election has big implications for all parts of our country, but also for tech and how it gets regulated. And the tech heavy hitters are lining up behind the candidates. What would government's role look like for artificial intelligence under a Trump presidency or a Harris administration? That's a question Anjana Susarla addressed in a recent article for The Conversation. She's a professor for responsible AI at Michigan State University's Broad College of Business, and she joins us now. Welcome to All Sides, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
There has been an explosion of generative AI since OpenAI released ChatGPT 2 years ago. Congress is still grappling with how to rein it in and what kind of guardrails we should put in place. So I want to start with President Joe Biden and his executive order last year that recognized the harm to civil and human rights that AI poses. What did his executive order do?
The executive order on AI outlined a whole set of, it outlines a framework more than anything else on, you know, the AI risk management. And it also established an office that sort of operates under the aegis of the FTC and other federal governments. So that office would have also some jurisdiction over what I would call as algorithmic harms. If you're using AI, if you're using any automated system, it doesn't have to be generative AI. Any automated system, we are deploying it, and you know, everything from education to who gets a loan, or deciding who is on priority to get a kidney transplant, there can be some risks with this kind of widespread deployment. So how do we manage, measure, map, assess those risks? What should be transparency norms in using these kinds of systems, et cetera?
How much of a role does the president play in shaping this kind of policy? Because I feel like, you know, passing laws to restrict mm-hmm. certain types of algorithms or certain types of artificial intelligence uses, that feels like Congress's job.
Yes. Well, there one thing that the federal government itself does a lot of procurement of artificial intelligence. Mm. So the federal agencies, there can be directives about how federal agencies actually use AI, and that might have some immediate impact. Other than that, what can the government take the lead in? They can also work with industry leaders to kind of have a dialogue, which is what Biden and, you know, Kamala Harris did when she was, some of her role. Can we adopt some voluntary standards that they will all conform to?
Yeah, we've had conversations about some of those standards on mm-hmm. this show, like watermarking images mm-hmm. and videos. You very clearly know that it's AI generated. Rules for how it reads books, which are people's copyright, how it reads articles from newspapers, how it collects the information that builds the AI.
Yeah. And, you know, different states now have taken the lead on different aspects. So California now has, I think, signed into law a bill that kind of requires transparency in the data collected by companies. So the federal government cannot do that. But I think what the federal government can do is to work with Congress and pass some legislation for maybe privacy, for requiring a little bit more, like digital watermarking types of issues, what you're talking about, more auditing, more standard reports on AI models, and the kind of even disclosure. If you're using a chatbot, you know, are you talking to a human versus an AI, having adequate level of transparency in everything, whether it's medical devices or, you know, some other technology. All those things, they're not directly under the legislative purview of the president, but president's office can play a role in bringing all these folks together.
So would Vice President Kamala Harris continue the Biden administration's lead, or has she said anything that she would go off in a different direction?
Broadly, it's expected in the responsible AI community that they've already signed that executive order. So the executive order recognizes that AI systems can pose unacceptable risks of harm. And, you know, Vice President Harris also took lead in the global AI leader. I think there were some forums she convened. So it's expected. I think we can expect that sort of trajectory. On the other hand, if it's a President Trump, a second administration, I think he's already said he will roll back the protections of the AI executive order. So we know that there is clearly a difference between the two administrations.
Former President Donald Trump has also, though, talked about the dangers of deep fakes, which, yeah, you know, would be his voice, his face, appearing to say things that are completely made up. Has he or Harris really laid out a plan to how to deal with AI generating, you know, people's voices, people's faces in fake ways?
I think there are already some bipartisan support for those kinds of things. And I've seen some initiatives in the Senate bills, etc. So we'll have to wait for leadership, maybe from those like senators and congressmen. And that may be something that can be done legislatively.
Another big topic of policy discussion is antitrust and mergers between these major technology companies. The Biden-Harris administration filed cases against Apple and Google, while the Trump administration tried to block AT&T's acquisition of Time Warner. So they've both weighed in at different moments on different corporate mergers.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's kind of not completely clear to me that Harris, if she's elected president, would continue the same Biden administrations. So everyone's kind of watching about would the same sort of regulatory philosophy or framework. It is clear, though, that some kind of antitrust technology policy intersecting antitrust will be a feature no matter which administration, because these companies play such a big role in our lives. And so I think we'll see some sort, maybe not to this extent. One like big policy win has been Google's antitrust. The FTC's has had some wins in against Google in the courts. So we'll see what happens to that.
We've also seen some pretty explosive, intense testimony from social media giants like Mark Zuckerberg before Congress. Any sense of what a Biden-Harris what a Harris administration or a Trump administration might do in championing reform of social media?
Well, you know, California, I think these are different directions potentially. Because one thing is, during COVID times, there was a lot of concern about health misinformation. And I think that will not continue if there was a second Trump administration. On the other hand, though, there is some, Texas has its own sort of social media bill or policy, as it were. And so we would expect more of those kinds of regulatory efforts, I think, in a second Trump administration.
Yeah, Ohio passed a law about how minors would access social media. Now, that's been blocked in court. It's been blocked in a lot of courts in a lot of states. So it feels like no matter who wins, those conversations will continue. We'll continue to move through the process.
Yes, and I think that broader conversations about AI's role in elections, AI's role in everyday life, what should be, people are using deepfakes for non-consensual purposes, those things are all happening at different state levels. So it would be good for anyone, no matter who's elected, to take some leadership and set an example or offer some direction to all these efforts.
When it comes to cryptocurrency, you see a big divide between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. The Trump campaign is the first presidential campaign to accept payment in cryptocurrencies. He's been critical of existing U.S. laws and called for the U.S. to be a, quote, Bitcoin superpower. So he is all in on crypto.
And that's fairly recent development. It's, you know, it was not the case earlier when he was in office. So the cryptocurrency, there is a very big movement by some prominent cryptocurrency in investors, etc., supporting President Trump for that reason.
Yeah, the Biden-Harris administration has laid out some regulatory restrictions on crypto, particularly with the Securities and Exchange Commission. I will say our own Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown has been a big proponent of cryptocurrency regulation. So it really is like two different ideas on what to do with this emerging currency market.
Yes, and I think it's a fairly complex set of transactions, and essentially there are issues with what happens if there's no liquidity, what is the microstructure of these Bitcoin trades, and I think that would be very completely different worlds, or it's almost two different parallel universes under a different administration.
Yeah, you sort of look at the prosecution of Sam Bankman-Fried and wonder how that would have gone down under a Trump administration.
Yes, that's very true. And it was very concerning, some of the things we heard during the Sam Bankman-Fried. And so hopefully, at least as citizens, we can all pay attention and, you know, we learn something from that.
We can't talk about tech and the election without talking about the titans pouring millions into these campaigns, particularly Elon Musk. He has made a major influx of cash, time, resources. The Get Out the Vote efforts in Pennsylvania are largely been given to Musk and his political PAC. How do you think this influence, this push, might impact tech policy?
Well, this is one of the, it's a bit of a concerning situation, honestly, because this is also an individual who has a lot of investments in things that are relating to national security, like satellites and so forth. So the idea of so much influence on the public sphere, information ecosystem, as well as the person who is, you know, influencing the space and sensitive sectors like that, transportation. I think this one, something I have written about and others have written about, is this does raise a lot of questions about essentially how much the person with, the monopolist has so much control over information ecosystem. And that's, I think, the more concerning thing to me.
Another major area of concern for everyday Americans is data privacy, data protection. How much all kinds of companies, even like my grocery store, is spying on me and my purchase habits. So Trump and his vice presidential pick, J.D. Vance, recently had their phones targeted by Chinese hackers. Are Trump and Harris, they seem to be, I guess, how do they differ on their data protection policies? Because they both seem pretty concerned with the idea of how much spying is happening.
Well, this is one area where neither of them has outlined any compelling plan. So I think it would be good, you know, individual states have done, I think California has tried to do some of those, and maybe we can extrapolate and say that maybe Kamala Harris would follow those kinds of policies, but that's
hard
not
to say. Yeah.
Yes.
And it's a little late in the game to ask them for their plan on data protection.
Definitely not when voting is already happening.
Final question for you. How much do you think the next president will impact the future of technology and artificial intelligence here in the United States?
Well, that's a very important question because, you know, if you look at the future, not to frame this kind of as an arms race between US and China, but in some sense, what is our advantage, our competitive strength? Is there some concerns relating to how innovative the US will continue to remain? And all the cutting edge technologies, are they going to come out of the United States? This is one area where I think no matter who gets elected, there will be some push because, you know, it's about our collective future and our ability to continue to innovate and thrive and, you know, be all the great things about the American economy, essentially.
That was Anjana Susarla, a professor of responsible AI at Michigan State University. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, artificial intelligence can give you the answer to all sorts of questions in seconds. But at what cost does that come from our power grid? That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. AI's ability to spit out answers to complex questions in seconds is pretty incredible. But that comes at a major cost to the environment. Let's look at it another way. The amount of energy ChatGPT uses to answer one question is about the equivalent of leaving an LED light bulb on in your home for 1 hour. And that's a cautionary tale here in Central Ohio, where we're becoming home to an ever-growing number of data centers. Microsoft last week announced a $1 billion investment in three of those centers in Licking County. Joining us now to talk about AI's impact on our environment is the Associate Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the University of California, Riverside. His name is Shao Ren, and he joins us now. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be here.
So you're working to make sure people understand the cost-benefit of AI technology and having us look at the environmental impacts in new ways. And I love the light bulb example because it's easy to contextualize. If I ask ChatGPT a question, this is what it costs.
Yep.
Do you have any other good comparisons? What if I ask it 10 questions? What if I treat it as my personal assistant?
So you can also compare it to the number of phone charges. So, of course, that depends on the model. If you choose a smaller model, in general, it consumes less energy. But some recent studies from Microsoft Research shows that if you just use a Llama 370B model, which is kind of a medium-sized large language model, writing two medium-sized emails could consume the amount of energy enough to give you a full iPhone full charge.
Just asking it to write two quick emails.
Yes. And actually, if you use a bigger model, let's say GPT-4, although we don't really know the exact size of GPT-4, but some other studies suggest that if you just write two emails using a large language model with similar size of GPT-4, it could be enough to drive a Tesla Model 3 for 1 mile.
Oh my gosh.
That's the energy consumption.
Yeah, the International Energy Agency says in 2026, electricity consumption at data centers will be more than double the amount in 2022, which is kind of mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, exactly. So this is the estimate for the International AI Data Center Energy Consumption. But if you look at the U.S., EPRI projects that by 2030, the U.S. data center could consume about 9% of the U.S. national energy consumption, electricity consumption. And if you look at a McKinsey estimate, the number is even higher. It's more than 11%.
I hate to ask, but I don't know that our grid is ready to handle that kind of rapid expansion.
Not yet. So that's why some technology companies are going to nuclear power. Yeah, it's just I think the current power grid infrastructure is definitely not ready for supporting this big expansion.
Yeah, it's Microsoft, right, that is bought or investing in Three Mile Island to convert it just to power its own systems.
Yes. And
a private company buying a nuclear power plant is wild.
Yeah, and Amazon, I think, is doing the same thing in another power plant, a nuclear power plant.
Yeah, in June, Google committed to investing an additional $2.3 billion into its data centers here in central Ohio. You know, Amazon says they're going to invest $7.8 billion. We're getting a lot of data centers here in the state of Ohio, and I wonder, like, what advice do you have for states that are becoming these hubs? Because I'm worried, like, is this going to increase, like, my electric bill? Like, how are we going to handle having all these new needs?
Well, I think the short answer is we don't really know. So there could be a potential utility rate spike for residents, but the connection definitely needs further investigation. We need better transparency from the power operators, from the tech companies. So we need more research to answer this question. But one thing to be sure is they need a lot of energy. And we're studying some of the public health impacts of this energy consumption, because we know that many power plants, even in the US, are using fossil fuels. So these have a lot of health impacts due to the air pollution, like PM2.5, sulfur dioxide. So these air pollutants can travel hundreds of miles, not thousands, but hundreds of miles across different states. So this could have some impacts on the public health. And we need some studies on this as well. And of course, there's a carbon emission greenhouse gas problem.
That's what I was going to ask. What impact could this have on climate change?
Though if you look at those tech companies' ESG report, their carbon emission definitely has increased dramatically. Partially, I think primarily due to AI computing.
These data and computing centers also generate quite a bit of heat and energy, and water is often used to cool them down. Have you started to model out how much water we're consuming? So, like, when I put a query into ChatGPT, how much water powers that?
Yes. So we did some study last year, and our earlier estimate shows that if you just have 10 to 50 queries with a large language model of like GPT-3, it could consume 500 milliliters of water to answer the questions. And that depends on where you are and how long your responses are. In general, locations with colder climates and also less water intensive electricity generation can support more queries for the same amount of water. But our estimate was based on a number reported by OpenAI quite a couple of years ago. If you look at more recent data for this energy consumption, actually, I believe that our estimate could be increased from 500 milliliters to about 2 liters. So, or even more.
Yeah, and for those wondering, 500 milliliters of water is a typical water bottle. So when you're looking at like a bottle of water, so a standard bottle of water is a conversation with ChatGPT, essentially.
Yeah, roughly.
Yeah, and running a light bulb or several light bulbs for several hours. I love that kind of analogy. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, or driving a Tesla Model 3.
Yeah.
For 1 mile.
I love those kinds of analogies because, like, I can conceive of it. Okay, so if I'm going to ask ChatGPT a dozen questions, it's going to take a bottle of water and a dozen light bulbs on for an hour or 12 hours on a light bulb. And you're like, okay, I have some, like, marker in my head of the energy consumption of something that arguably just takes me seconds to do.
Yes. But let's be fair, it's not only ChatGPT,
no, okay.
But also other models.
I should be fair. It's just the one that's most common. Yes, 100%. It is not just them. It's any large language learning model. It could even be, you know, what I find interesting, programs like Grammarly, which is meant to correct your grammar. It offers predictive changes. They're like, hey, this is passive voice. Would you like to reword it this way? That is artificial intelligence.
Yeah, that in general, that's broadly considered as artificial intelligence. But I don't think they're really using large language models. They're probably using smaller, much, much smaller models. So in terms of
Much
the
less
energy and
cost.
environmental impacts, yeah, much less.
That's good to know.
But the quality is a different story.
Yeah, you can use large language models, any open AI source, to do the same thing, ask for the same predictions, and that would be more costly on the energy grid.
Yeah. In
Yeah.
general, that's the trend. That's the case.
So Google struck a partnership with EDP Renewables in North America. They're trying to create a solar energy portfolio with projects Google says will mainly be in Ohio. So, I mean, at least companies are considering renewable energies, solar energies. I mean, nuclear is its whole other debate about the safety, the renewability, the security of it. But at least seems like there is a conversation towards how do we build a more sustainable grid that could support AI integration.
Right. So I think this all these major tech companies are investing in renewable energy, but the key problem is they still have to plug their data center into the main grid, because renewables energy are not stable and cannot provide energy 24/7. To store those massive energy, it requires a huge amount of battery units. Additionally, oftentimes the location to build solar farms is not the best location to build data centers. So that's why we're not seeing data centers directly powered by renewables. Instead, they're just st still using our grid, and they still use the transmission lines, and the renewable is just more like an offsetting method.
These large language models need to be trained. Does the training consume similar amounts of water and electricity?
Well, training is one time, but it consumes substantially more energy and water and carbon emission. So, if you look at training a large language model like GPT-3 or sorry, Llama 3.1, the energy is about four, I think more than 4,000 megawatt hour energy. So that's roughly the monthly household energy consumption for about by about 4,000, I think 4,000 households. Monthly energy, electricity consumption, just for training one model, and
Wow.
they're training, many hundreds of models. We have by many different companies, and they're still continuously training more and more models.
What do you think we should be thinking about in terms of, say, federal regulation, state regulation? How should we be conceiving of, like, should we put in any parameters on how they get their energy or where it's coming from? Because I do think there's something fundamentally weird about the idea of Microsoft owning a nuclear power plant.
I think we should have a standard at least, if not regulations. If you look at the European Union, they already have this AI Act, which requires a disclosure of energy consumption, water consumption, carbon emission for data centers. But we don't have something anything similar in the US. So I guess at least there should be a standard to benchmark the energy consumption, environmental impacts of this computing, because it's just getting really essential part of our lives. So we have a pretty good idea of how much water, how much energy, how much carbon each food item consumes. For example, the sandwich or beef producing 1 kilogram of beef requires several thousand liters of water. But most of that water is actually green water used to grow the grasses that feed the cattle. So essentially, it's the supply chain water for the beef. But for AI computing, we just don't have that knowledge. We have the information is extremely limited. Even though I think now many people are using these services, and we still don't have the idea.
That was Shao Ren, Associate Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at the University of California, Irvine. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you all for listening here to All Sides. Our staff includes Senior Producer Marcus Charleston, Producer Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, intern producers Kira Kadar, Chris Corcoran, and David Stein. Video production by the Ohio Channel, and our board operator today was Cameron Howard. Thank you all for listening to All Sides, right here on 89.7 NPR News.